Hello and welcome to the 21CB thing. I'm Damasara and I'm here with Taupata and Singharava.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome. Three people today.
Yeah.
Very excited. Great. Well, I'm very excited because Singharava and I, we go way back. We've lived together. We've done loads of activities together, young Buddhist activities, and I'm just very happy. It's the three of us now. We can share inspiration. And I think we just plunge right in.
Let's go
in there. And well, we have, like last week, we have quotes. We bought Buddhist quotes, so I just hand over to Singharava, and you can present your inspiration with us.
Okay, cool. It's a very exciting moment to sit here with you two and the three.
It's an honor. We're honored.
It's an honor. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, I decided to bring a poem that is on my mind, or has been on my mind in the last days. Mm-hmm. And it's by Sangharakshita. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I probably read it first and then we can see if we can go deeper into it. So this poem is called The Golden Flower. So love grew up between us like a flower, though neither made a sign or breathed a word, content to watch it growing hour by hour and see its petals by the breezes stirred. At length it grew to such a breadth and height, it stood there like a mighty forest tree with thousand glorious petals golden bright, and I could not see you, nor you see me. And so the flower, for both, is all in all. Though each is in the flower in each, and each in each forever past recall, a mystery this, beyond the grasp of speech. You look really serious.
That's the face you're supposed to have when you listen to poems.
Yeah. Yeah,
serious face.
It's poetry.
Poetry face.
Serious answer. Very highbrow.
Yes. That's probably the most highbrow thing we've done here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very good. No, I like the... it just reminds me of the thousand-petaled lotus. Yeah.
Do you remember it was a poem that we also used for the Young Buddhist Convention
exactly,
in 2017, which was an inspiration back then for the mandala of the lotus petals that we created. But I think, I mean, I really love it because it talks about something that is really, it's not easy to grasp at the first place. But then I think, it talks about love as actually the goal of the spiritual life somehow, and also the a way of completely losing your ego, and like the flower is something that is there and it's there for the people who participate in creating it somehow, and they lose themselves, and I think that's quite inspiring in a way.
So is it a kind of a metaphor for meta?
Yeah,
meta being
a metaphor.
Yes, whatever, you know what I mean.
Could you read the first verses again, maybe, the first lines?
So love grew up between us like a flower, though neither made a sign or breathed a word, content to watch it growing hour by hour and see its petals by the breezes stirred.
It's this lovely image of something springing up, but there's no apparent connection between the people or, well, communication or whatever, but it's something that goes kind of, goes beyond them in a way, goes beyond the people,
Yeah, it's not like a conscious thing, because it says, no, though neither made a sign or breathed the word, so it's not that you control it or you kind of say, okay, this is what we do now. It's just something that grows organically and naturally. And there's also this receptivity to just see it growing and not interfere too much with it.
Because that was, as you said, that was the inspiration. So in 2017, we did we thought we'd bring together loads of young Buddhists from all over Europe to Berlin, and that was kind of our vision to think, well, how do you create a spiritual community with people who come from very, very different countries, very, very different cultures. So there needs to be something that goes beyond the people, which is, well, you know, Buddhist practice, which is inspiration, which is, well, friendship, really. And that sort of, so we created the, it's still down in the basement. That's what it is.
Yeah. Okay, so in the basement, there's a kind of hanging with a kind of flower. Yeah, so that's you. And everyone else.
Yeah.
It's good to know these things.
Everyone could create a petal and just become part of that.
Very good.
That is a super personal structure and super personal thing.
Well, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Because that whole thing about mandalas being stylized flowers or stylized lotus in a way. And a mandala, well, it's a circle of some meaning, isn't it? A circle of friendship and... what is a mandala? For those that don't know,
mandala is I don't know, like concentric. It has concentric circles usually, but it sort of has a center, and then everything else is sort of placed in accordance with the center.
So there's like meaning. The most, the highest meaning is in the middle, in a way, and everything else in your life revolves around that. It's interesting. Obviously, it's something that was part of Sangharakshita's. I don't know, because you can see him in many ways, can't you? You can see him in a kind of, some people have quite a, I don't know, see him as quite a stern figure, or there's all sorts of different versions of him in people's mind. But he was very, obviously, he wrote a lot of poetry, and love was obviously the main driving factor in his communication with people.
Now, I think that's what strikes me usually in his poetry, and also in this one, it's just the love, which is kind of tangible in his words. There's other great poem, The Veil of Stars. Maybe we'll have to bring that in another episode. But that just really touched me. Like, it was such a... You think, oh, wow, I've never... It's a completely different person to his lectures, really, because there's just this overwhelming love for... At first a person, but then it kind of transcends itself. So he goes from loving a particular person and love not being, it doesn't come back. So he isn't being loved back. So it's unreturned love. But then it kind of uses that to transcend love, and it becomes compassion. It's this great verse where he says, love bows at its master, compassion and retreats, and compassion can arise. So something about that in that poem as well.
It's true. I mean, it really speaks from a deep personal experience, I think, that is quite profound. And I also love, because you mentioned that a metaphor for spiritual love, and I think because he uses that image of the thousand glorious petals, like at length it grew to such a breadth and height, it stood there like a mighty forest tree with thousand glorious petals golden bright, and I could not see you nor you see me. And I think it's because that is also the image of the thousand petaled lotus is the Indian image of the crown center, the highest psychic center. I think it's also a metaphor for something that grows to such a spiritual hate, in a sense.
What I was just thinking is that, you know, it's a mighty forest tree. So I think that's quite important, because that means that compassion or love is something, you know, it's quite tricky sometimes to talk about love and think, oh, you know, it's a very sentimental kind of touchy-feely kind of thing. You know, I'm not interested in that, really. I'm interested about the... You know, the deep feeling for someone, you know, the deep feeling for a person, the deep care you have for people. I mean, I think we have that in, you know, in the order, you have friendships where you really deeply care for people. But I can also translate that into people. I sometimes feel that when we do newcomers classes, you know, when I see someone, I just really, you know, that can then kind of spill over as well and invite up more people and just really care for people. That's why we meet loads of people, because we kind of... yeah, we try to well, let them see the mighty forest tree, as it were, yeah, of spiritual practice, yeah.
Yeah, and then I think because it's so mighty, and it's there in itself in its own right, you can really kind of let go of your own personal identity and ego clinging, because you just become part of it somehow. So yeah, so this is you just become part of that flower, and somehow you're in the flower, and the flower is in you, and it's inseparable in a sense, but it's not you anymore, like, yeah. So that's
yeah. It's this, you can't see me and I can't see you.
Yeah. I could not see you nor you see me. And then he goes on and he says, so the flower for both is all in all, though each is in the flower in each, and each in each forever past recall, a mystery this beyond the grasp of speech. So it's more like, yeah, really becoming part of that.
Do you have an experience of that? Is there something from your retreat experience or something where you can kind of relate to what he says there?
That's a good question. I have had moments at retreats when I thought, after a couple of days of silence, how people start to move, like in meditation retreats, it becomes really like this improvisation and a dance, and we're all dancing together somehow. So I think I have an experience of something where, yeah, people together become a mandala of beauty somehow. And there, so that's what comes in my mind immediately, but I probably... Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes there are moments when something different comes, even if it's just for very short glimpses or...
Yeah. I think especially in... I think it really talks about community in a way, doesn't it, that poem? I think the only way that I can think of it in my own practice is... Well, again, we've talked about it a lot, but the four-month ordination retreat, you know, when... All of a sudden, it's not just about you, but, you know, everyone's going through a deep phase of transformation. And then also just to sort of live with loads of, with those people for a long time and just deeply practicing, it becomes something where you fill up the whole valley in a way, fill up the whole retreat center. I mean, I remember one guy on my course saying after the 4 months, he said, well, he feels like we've been living in a palace because if you look at the huts that we lived in there, you know, they would leak, you know, would rain in them, and there was no insulation, no heating, nothing. It was basically a little bit better than camping. But at the end he said, well, he feels like we've been living in a palace because of the, well, it just highlights the strength of the mind, doesn't it? Kind of the our practice really, you know, it was filling out the whole valley. And well, again, Maitreya Bandhu, he made the comparison of you know, we were living in double scale, which is what Renaissance painters used, you know, because they didn't paint in perspective, but they painted in, you know, people are usually big as the house or something, but it was in terms of importance. You know, like a big figure would be really important, and then a small figure wouldn't be as important. So it wasn't perspective, it was double scale. Yeah, you had different scales. So he made a comparison of, well, we sort of, with our minds, we've kind of filled out the valley, and kind of through the practice, through the brotherhood between us, we filled out the whole space. Yeah.
Well, I think that's interesting, because you do get a sense of what's possible on retreat. It kind of raises the bar, doesn't it? You know, you can end up with a sort of a mandala. I wouldn't say it's a perfect world, but, you know, you've got a sense of people that are really aware of each other in a completely different way, isn't it? When you leave, it's a bit of a strange experience. It feels like it almost wasn't real, because it just dissolves at the end of a retreat. But something kind of carries on from there, especially if you keep going on retreat and you're seeing the same people again and again. But Yeah, it's quite, it's really something, isn't it? It shows you, you kind of live in a completely different way to what you would normally experience. And I think that's what people experience, especially when they first go on retreat. You know, it's so, it can be such an eye-opener that you turn up and it's like, oh, wow, this is actually possible. It's not fake. It's not everyone's just trying to be nice to each other. It's like, well, like the poem, you know, something arises between you all doing this stuff together without trying to push anything or trying to be something. Mm. It just sort of arises by itself and gives you a sense of what's actually possible rather than one's day-to-day sort of runnings in a way.
Mm.
I think that, I just remember the strongest experience of that was probably also those 10 days when Bhante died. Mm. And mm. I was at Adisthana at that time. And mm. I think that felt really strongly like there was something, there was just a bigger spirit, mm. something going on between the community. Mm. And so everyone was just contributing on a very day-to-day normal way, and at the same time there was this whole consciousness, something mm-hmm. that was much wider mm-hmm. present there, and somehow it felt really like all the things harmoniously integrated into mm. that and brought mm. that in a very peaceful way into being. So mm. I think that was really, really present there.
Mm-hmm. So. And yet at the same time, I think when you're on retreat, and even if you're living in those ideal conditions, sometimes you can't recognize that it is ideal at the moment. Like, I think it just those perfect conditions when they come together, it's the closest. I always imagine, well, it's kind of the ideal meeting reality, because sort of underlying you can feel actually, yeah, this is the best way to live now. But at the same time, your mind is still well, not, you know, you're still distracted. You're still, I don't know, don't like what that guy just said or something. You know, you're still in your normal mode. But then when you leave those conditions, then you feel the pain. Yeah, then you feel the pain of, ooh, yeah, actually, that was really good. But I couldn't recognize it at the time.
Well, it's quite interesting because you can kind of, it goes to show you do kind of collectively raise your consciousness, if you want to use that language. Mm. Which is why I think when you go off retreat again, it's sometimes quite difficult to want to go back on retreat because you're in a completely different state of mind. You're busy, you're running around. And well, I think, you know, it's like, oh, do I really want to go and spend my time with loads of other people and wash up and meditate all day? And then you get there and then your mind state changes again. Mm. And you remembered why. It's like there's two different minds going on.
Mm.
There's one mind who's kind of on a hamster wheel and another mind. The one that's on the hamster wheel doesn't want to go back on retreat.
Mm.
But then you get back on your retreat, you're like, wow, okay, this is possible again. It's a strange dance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, actually, my quote that I brought is also from the Dhammapada, like last week, old Buddhist scripture. And I think it fits quite well, actually, with the same topic. Mm. Sometimes funny how these things go. It's a famous one. I think you will know it. But I really like it, and it's kind of like a mantra in my head a lot when I think about community and friendship. And it's from the chapter about happiness, It goes like this. Happy indeed we live, friendly amid the haters. Among men who hate, we dwell free from hate. Happy indeed we live, healthy amid the sick. Among men who are sick, we dwell free from sickness. Happy indeed we live, content amid the greedy. Among men who are greedy, we dwell free from greed. Happy indeed we live, we for whom there are no possessions. Feeders on rapture shall we be, like the gods of brilliant light. Which for me is just a fantastic evocation of the ideal of the spiritual community.
That's quite interesting. Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, in terms of like a vision for, I don't know, about a people or a religion, it's quite different, isn't it? Because you're within a world and you might be surrounded by all this stuff, but you're still happy in a way. You've still found freedom within that. It's not like you're going to change the whole world. The whole world's going to explode and then something's going to come down and everyone's going to be rescued. It's not really saying that, is it? It's like you've got this kind of, well, frankly, this world's a disaster a lot of the time, but without getting into a kind of protectionist thing where you kind of seal yourself off from the world, you can still I mean, it's a bit of a turnaround. You can still be happy within that, within that world, and not in a selfish kind of retracted way. I think that's what drew me to Buddhism in the first place. And I thought, oh, this is just how it's going to be, isn't it? If it's ever going to work, it's going to be like that. This world isn't going to change. It's going to carry on as it is. But within that, there's these strange, you get strange formations of people that try and do this other thing and they can be happy within that, actually.
And it's more, I think what this highlights, these lines highlight, is that you need to plant the seed within the mess, in a way. You know, the spiritual community sort of has to start within.
In the mud.
The lotus again. The lotus. The very thousand petal lotus in the
dirt.
In the dirt. And it also reminded me of, it's very similar to the dedication ceremony, some lines of it, although in the world there's strife and so.
Yeah.
And I think it's nice because that's what when we dedicate a place, that's what we're trying to do, to create that space that's within the rest of the society, works on a different level of experience, consciousness.
Yeah, it's a bit like you say with, you know, we don't think, oh, something will come down and kind of, or there will be an end time and then from there on there's the kingdom of heaven or something static. But it's more like, well, you kind of need to see how to create those islands of conditions, really. And it, I mean, if you are on retreat, you those are those tiny islands, you know, like when you're on... Yeah. Well, those 4 months in Goshiloka, but also just a weekend retreat here in Brandenburg, you know, it's very fragile. Like you can see your mind trying to destroy it immediately with, you know, with all sorts of distractions, or people just want to go home again, or, you know, it's a very, very subtle, fragile thing.
Oh, that's interesting. That's it, though, isn't it? I mean, like in terms of, you're not looking to, it's gone from my mind. I had it and it went. Sorry.
No.
Doesn't matter. It's fine. Carry on.
It's gone. It's good.
We'll come back. Sometimes it comes back later.
Yeah.
It's coming. It's winding through the universe into my brain at the moment.
Yeah, but it's probably really kind of. I mean, I love those metaphors, the gardening metaphors for the spiritual life, like planting a seed and trying to find conditions that it can grow and that seeds can flourish somehow. And that's probably being really conscious about the conditions that are needed in order to make the flower grow and make that become a forest tree.
That's interesting because I met with a friend recently. Hello, Fabian. well, we were talking about, you know, how difficult it is to follow certain rules, or, you know, to become a vegetarian, or even to meditate every day. And I've recently, more and more, I see how it isn't about me and my kind of internal. I don't know, like, am I a person who can just follow these kind of rules, or like, is it, you know, I've stopped thinking about myself as one who is disciplined to meditate every day, or who is disciplined to not eat meat or something. But I've really seen how in different situations and different conditions, you are a completely different person. So this is, you know, I told him, well, you know, when I was living alone, I could never meditate in the morning, like 10 minutes every morning was way too much for me. Like I was just, but then Singarava and I, we formed this community, and then it was quite easy because I knew there were people, and you have this, I think we don't really realize how much we rely on conditions and other people also setting an example for us. And because then it's quite easy, you know, if you have three other people who meditate every day in the morning, it's quite easy then to just kind of hook on and follow that. So I think in this way, this is the whole reason why we talk so much about community and also communal living or communal practice, because I mean, it's quite astonishing when people go forth and live in a cave somewhere and meditate. But I think for most of us, we need to have something to really hook onto, you know, to people who are actually disciplined in one area, where you can just actually follow them.
I guess it relates to willpower as well, doesn't it? Because you can only use your willpower to set up conditions.
Yeah.
You can't willpower your way through the spiritual life.
No.
I mean, you can do that for a couple of weeks and then you end up with a migraine and it's all finished. But you can use your willpower to do like what you two did. You can set up a community and choose who you live with, and you just know that these people, there'll be a kind of habit, some habits that will emerge that would be really positive and they'll carry you through. But yeah, you can't. I think it's quite a big distinction. For me, it was a big distinction just to figure out, to have a sense of what, how this actually works. The fact that I can't just be heroic, you know, all the time. And although the heroic ideal is a big part of Buddhism, it's like, you can't be heroic in that willful way. It's more like you've got to be smart, isn't it? It's like you've got to look at your life and make difficult decisions, but then hopefully those decisions mean that the decision's made and then what happens next carries you along a bit, whether it's moving to a community or changing your work or whatever it is, you know?
It's very important, yeah. And in the scriptures, in the Pali Canon, I mean, there's so many verses about, like, choose with whom you spend your time with. Yes. You know, spend your time with spiritually mature people, but not with spiritually immature people. You know, people, because they're so influenced in a way.
It gets more. I think that whole thing though, it gets more and more subtle, doesn't it? Because in the beginning, it's like you might have a load of friends that are drinking a lot and taking drugs and selling drugs and all sorts of people like this, and it's like, well, these people, that's not working. But then you get in with other people and then it gets more and more subtle, doesn't it? Because then you end up with people. And in the end, you end up with in a situation like, is this person really energized in this? Or is this a bit wishy-washy? And goes from being like really gross, like people that are having a very negative effect on your life to actually,
It's interesting. There was another quote I was looking at from the Sutta Nipata, and the whole thing is about the rhinoceros. You know, the rhinoceros walks alone.
Oh yeah.
You should walk alone through the forest. Yeah, it's very, very much sort of. It kind of appeals to your individual faculty. You know, like you need to be able to live alone. But then there's one verse that says, "But if you find someone who is." I can't remember what it was, well-versed in the scriptures or something, or, you know, deep in training and spiritually mature, then do follow him, do walk with him. If you can't find a person like that, you should walk alone in the forest like the rhinoceros.
It's
quite strong.
It is strong.
It's the only verse.
Yeah, well, that's really something, isn't it? Yeah. And like, I guess the whole thing is to generate a culture. Mm. Well, to go back to the poem in a way, you're generating a culture of... Yeah, between you, where you can achieve something. You can achieve something that's not just a load of people kind of with their individual skills, but you something gets generated between you, which is sort of, when it happens, it's quite shocking, isn't it? You get a little glimpse of it. It's really inspiring. Mm. Well, like you were saying, it's like you lose, it's you kind of, your ego is attenuated, or whatever the word is. Mm. And you end up with something more interesting.
Mm.
It's not less. It's not like you evaporate. I think just, you know, collectively, it's kind of more interesting somehow. Mm. Anyway.
Yeah, I think it reminded me the rhinoceros quote of a sutta also, where the Buddha also says, okay, like if you happen to find company with people where you notice that your heart matures, and you actually gain insight, and you make progress in meditation, then you should just stay. It's not that he's just saying like there are different conditions. Okay, if you find company with people and then you notice you're not developing, then you should move on. But if you found some people, then stay.
That's interesting. It's a totally different way to navigate your life, then, isn't it? Yeah, you know, it's not based on your what you might call your individual achievements, but on what your, well, it's a bit more existential, isn't it? It's like your immediate, like, oh God, these are the people that's actually going to allow me to grow, or you move on. But I mean, it's a completely different way of organizing your life, isn't it? Like what your direction in life actually. Because I don't know, it seems these days especially you can kind of hop from city to city, and you know, do this here and do this there, and it's all about
backpack.
And yeah, it's fine, but you're going to get your career going, boom, boom, boom. Nothing wrong with that. But it's a completely different way of navigating the world, isn't it? So, oh, I've actually found some people that are actually on this and really going for it. I should stay with them.
Yeah,
it's a different. It's a completely different set of factors to determine what you're supposed to do with your life, isn't it? Yeah. Mm.
And just thinking about the mighty forestry flower that is created through community. I think I was just thinking with this whole thing about insight and losing your ego. It's more. It's not that you lose it, but it's that. You can, as you said, you can let go into something bigger. Mm. So sometimes I feel that when, sometimes in our classes we have the Friday night that the three of us lead, something, it's almost as if you don't really lose your ego, but you start to feel like something else is emerging below the surface. And this is kind of how it feels like, I think.
It's a language problem we've got though, isn't it? Because I think that, I mean, it's, I don't want to go on bashing the whole kind of non-self thing. It's boring, but there's a kind of language problem there, isn't it? Because it's like, you know, when you translate all this into the modern, you know, modern culture or whatever, you end up with this whole slightly nihilistic, losing this and losing that, and then you never really had an ego to begin with, so you can't lose, and it's all framed in a negative, and it's very difficult to come up with easy catchphrases that are memorable, which say what you just said, and you know, in a way what this poem's saying, it's like it's difficult to come up with something which says it's not just you losing your ego, there's not an easy way to say you merge into something, or you're moving into a much broader almost non-personal, but then not impersonal space. There's no easy, you can't say, oh, it's called this or called that. That's essentially what's happening.
Yeah, because that is mystery, this beyond the grasp of speech.
Oh, there you go. That's the final words, that's the punchline. Yeah, so here we are trying to talk about it, but you can't.
It's really difficult. Yeah, yeah. I also love that poem because the golden flower. Sagarakshita wrote about it because it is the actual symbol and the myth of the Zen tradition where the Buddha held up the golden flower in his communication with Mahakashyapa, and he was the only one who to understand what that meant, and all the others didn't get it. It was the initial act of transmitting something that is beyond the grasp of speech, because it is something which Sangharakshita called the spirit of Buddhism that needs also be transmitted.
The whole thing about it being caught not taught. I had this conversation yesterday with Max. Hello, Max. And we're just talking about this whole thing. He was reading The Way of the White Clouds by Lama Govinda, this German mystic, well, Buddhist friend of Sangharakshita's. And just all this lineage of teachers, and it's like a force that just comes through the ages. And I think that's what gives me faith when I'm feeling a bit, I don't know it. Well, you know, when you get these horrible moments of doubt that just cripple you. But just this sense of like, oh, right, Sangharakshita was there and he just got hit. Well, he got this force came over from Tibet when the Chinese moved in. And these people that are really, and it's like, you can't teach it. You can't read it in a book. You can read all the words. It's irrelevant. You actually meet somebody that is that force that's been dwelling in that place. And that's how it gets transmitted. And then you think, oh, well, I'm a recipient to some degree of this, whatever this is. So let's not even call it something, because like it says, it's like it's a mystery to words. You can't kind of, you can't verbalize it. You lose it in the verbalizing. It just gets very wordy and technical, and actually it's not the thing itself. That is partially, there's one of the wonderful things about the internet and at the moment, you know, is that you can kind of talk to people from all over the world, and maybe you can't get to a Buddhist center and all this, and that's brilliant. And something comes across the kind of digital airwave, so to speak, but actually you have to be with people. You have to be with people, because there's something it's beyond just a kind of information. It's not just information, is it?
It's the mind, really, isn't it? Like the mind meeting the mind. I was just thinking about the ungraspable spirit. I think that has been the problem of Buddhism throughout all the ages, to kind of really make people understand what it actually is, because starting first with the Buddha, obviously he first thought, oh no, I can't teach any of this, no one will understand, and then you know, he saw that, oh, well, maybe a few people will actually understand. But if you also then just look at, you know, just looking at Buddhist traditions and throughout history, it's always like someone comes along, says, or has a kind of new formulation of a teaching, you know, like it's like an emergence of inspiration. And then that kind of, and then people are like, ah, oh, okay, it's like that. Okay, great. And then they follow that. And then it degenerates again, and then people kind of stick to the letter again.
Why does it degenerate?
Well, I think it's because
the spirit is gone.
The spirit, because the spirit is manifested in the people who, like you say, you need to be with someone who is a great exemplar of that spirit. Like, so it's not just the person, it's not just the words, it's not just the formulations, but it's also the person, you know, trying to kind of formulate his or her own inspiration into something concrete, and then obviously throughout the ages,
and I mean, you do
get lost. Yeah, but then someone else comes along.
Because I think what you need is, of course, a degree of transcendental insight in a way, like to kind of nourish that spirit. Mm. And if that gets lost, then you can't kind of revitalize it somehow just from the letters. Mm.
And in a way, it's not just an individual, is it? It's not just an individual. Well, it is a person, like someone like Sangharakshita came along and the conditions were ripe and then communicated something, but it is a communal thing as well, isn't it? It's like if you have it's kind of like an, I don't know about paradox, but it's like a bit like a paradox, isn't it? You've got a kind of a collective, well, it's like Sangharakshita's whole thing, a collective of individuals, and that keeps the spirit of it. It's like you've got hopefully a number of people all kind of on the same page, and you can walk into an atmosphere then, can't you? And you can't just bring that out of thin air. It's like some places you walk into, you can tangibly feel it, can't you? You're like, you couldn't really say what it is, but there's something there. And other places you go, you're like, something's not here.
Mm.
And then it's sort of dead. It's formalism. It's kind of clever words and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, some places are alive, aren't they? It's as simple as that. And maybe I find that really quite, it's like mysterious, this whole thing of it traveling through time in a way, this, whatever this is, maybe it splits into different rivers over here, goes to Japan, goes to Sri Lanka, where all these different places ended up here, but it's all the same, it's kind of the same thing in a way, but working through multiple people and communities and sometimes it sort of tapers off and sometimes it kind of flowers.
Mm.
Ta-da. Jesus. Slick.
Podcast of bad jokes. Yeah. No, I was just thinking that's exactly, I mean, I look into Japanese Buddhism a lot, and you can kind of see individual people who try to create something, and then they really, you know, like Kukai or something, you can really see, oh, there's something there with him that really inspired a lot of people. And then you can, I don't know, you look 200 years later and you already see, oh, it starts, people start interpreting it in a different kind of way, and it starts to kind of mix with other things and it's not as clean anymore. And then someone else comes along and says, oh, no, actually, the Dharma is like that. So it's always a corrective in a way. There's always inspiration. Well, the nature of inspiration is that it can't be, you know, that it isn't slick. It's it needs to be some sort of corrective, or it needs to be free from wordings or something.
Yeah. I think that's one of, there's many great things that Sangharakshita has kind of given, but one of them is that awareness over the situation we're in.
Yeah.
So you don't just keep going and wonder why in 50 years you don't have any Buddhism, or your Buddhist centers are all flatlined. You know, it's like I think people are quite aware of that within Tree Ratna, which is one of the reasons I think it's great. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, there's a sense that this, it's not a given, you know. You need to really be aware of this whole process and really be generating that spiritual heat.
And it's really inspiring as well to kind of be in the position of kind of having to think and reflect what is the actual presentation of the Dharma for our situation right now, right here. So I think, like, because I think that that's also something that creates intensity. It creates something to not kind of just follow something that is there and there is a certain set of practices, but to kind of really think, okay, what's what's...
Mm. It's more mysterious though, isn't it?
It's more mysterious because you really need to need to become a translator or interpreter for the world in which you live.
And I guess you need to find, in order for it to be alive, make it alive in yourself, which is a huge deal really, isn't it? How that happens as well. Yeah. So I guess it's individual responsibility as well, isn't it?
Well, the image I have for that is that, you have a sort of, you have the abstract, you have the ideal, you have the Dharma, you have enlightenment, and then you're trying to kind of let it appear in the realm we're in right now. You want those two worlds to meet, the plane that we're in right now, the unenlightened, messy, humane kind of world. You're trying to let that meet with the Dharma, the enlightenment. I mean, picking from Christianity, I mean, this is kind of the whole myth of, Jesus becoming, like God become man in a way, because this is kind of what, in very non-traditional words, they wouldn't probably quite put it like that, but they would see, well, is an attempt of showing, well, yeah, there needs to be a communication between, the highest ideal, they would call it the divine, but we would probably call it enlightenment or whatever it is. And then, so it's that myth of, well, a being who's both on a higher plane, but also on our plane. So he or she can talk in both languages. And I think this is kind of what we are trying to do in practice, is to try to sort of, well, be in samsara, be in unenlightened, in the unenlightened realm, which changes all the time. Well, then let something else shine through, through receptivity, through... but we've talked about visualization practices.
That's a very good way of subtilizing the myth. Subtilizing? But no, I don't know if that's a word, forget it. But, the whole thing of... well, it's about getting real, isn't it? It's like there's not some... Well, I'd assume there's not some kind of fantastical world somewhere else where, you've got this experience right now, and how do you I don't know, live at your highest somehow? Mm-hmm. How do you... Well, what is it for a start? We all take it for granted, don't we, that we're just on this level. And I think it makes to do literalism, isn't it? Because if you stick on that level, then you think, oh, somewhere else is this other higher world where I'll exist in a higher world. And you kind of put off the work for a whole lifetime. It makes life a bit easier, doesn't it? It's like, oh, that's really, living a spiritual life is actually quite difficult. So I'll sort of put that off and do a few rituals.
But it's really hard.
It's really hard because you're trying to more subtilize your day-to-day moments. You have breakfast. It's, you've got stomach upset. Whatever's going on, there's all this stuff going on. That's like, oh, this is not the stuff. And it is the stuff. It's your mind, isn't it? And I just find that kind of inspiring. I thought, okay, even within this moment and this kind of, Monday. Dualism, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I'm getting bored of my voice.
I think it's just the friction between the ideal and the reality that does the job somehow. And it's great to kind of create that tension and to always kind of become aware of the gap. Because then you also, I notice where the work is that I need to do. And I also feel like it's good in order to get a sense of, humility in a sense, like if you really notice the difference between the ideal, it's a really good way of practicing.
Oh yeah, you get humbled, don't you?
Yeah, it's very humbling in a way.
A worm, you little worm.
No, but not in a negative sense.
No.
So.
But I'm very, I mean, that's a big part of my practice because I'm so bad with it. Because every time I go on retreat or on solitary, I think, like, my expectation is I will enter paradise, and it'll be so easy, and, it's just Buddha land, and I just do rituals, like you say, and it'll be fine. And then I just experience this painful friction for most of the solitary until at the very end, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, it's about...
But that's good, though, isn't it? I mean, in a way, that's good because...
It's not about expecting something to come down. It's actually, you actually have to
but it's
be
like
here.
Raising the bar, do you know what I mean? I think that's good because then that shows that you at least you don't get into a state where you think, oh, yeah, I'm doing great. And I mean, like in a kind of clunky sense, like, oh, yeah. Because actually, it's really difficult, isn't it? And when you go on solitary, you just get faced with that immediately. Oh, actually, I'm not living at the level I want to live at.
Because, and I think that also brings us back to the question of the conditions, because I think there's also a danger of, like, for example, living in a community and meditating regularly, that you forget that this is due to the conditions that you have. And you might think, oh, it's... I'm a good meditator, and then suddenly it's me. Yeah, yeah. So I think
well, you can even turn off in those conditions as well, can't you? You live in a community and you think, oh, I've ticked all the boxes now. I live in a community, I meditate every day, I'm doing it. Yeah, but that's not it. That's something just something. There's that kind of intensity. And where does that come from? Because I've done that myself loads, you know. I've ticked all the boxes, but I've just ticked the boxes. I'm just a bit tepid, lukewarm. So getting that real... I don't know, getting to that point where you feel kind of satisfied with your practice in a real way of, wow, that's a whole lifetime's work. I feel like it takes, well, it probably takes lifetimes, doesn't it, to get yourself together so that you're all the kind of things, the kind of superfluous, the unimportant things just start falling away, and you're kind of funneled perhaps or opened into that's like a God, that's a big, oh God.
Yeah.
it's big. That'll do. Jesus.
Where does Jesus come from?
I don't know. Where does he come from? So that's my question. What I wanted to ask is, where does Jesus come from? Yeah, that's my question.
From
the
heaven.
From where?
Heaven.
Heaven, yeah.
No, but going back to the solitary, that's kind of exactly where... what I meant is, like, I have breakfast, I study, I meditate, but then all those different bits, in my experience, don't seem to add up to anything. Like, as you say, you have the bits of the day.
That's what I was trying to say.
Thank you. Then they just kind of, they don't add up to something bigger.
Yeah.
And that is super painful for me, but I just have to then learn to kind of step back a bit and wait for it to get a momentum, because then once, like, after usually 7 days or longer, it actually then starts to generate momentum.
That's where you need experience, though, isn't it? You need some experience to understand that. Well, it's like karma, isn't it? The whole thing about planting seeds.
Yeah.
You planted it, and then you think, well, this is a disaster. Nothing's happened. I've been here a whole day.
Yeah.
Nothing's happened. Yeah, but it'd probably take 2 weeks to get a momentum going. Yeah, 3 weeks, maybe 2 months. I've definitely had periods where I've just fallen off completely. Mm. I was quite lucky in a way. I was really going for it. Then I completely fell off for about 6 months. It didn't come back overnight. Whatever was there before, that was running before, this kind of positive energy, it took a whole year, maybe more, before anything started coming back online. And I was like, oh wow, okay, that's like momentum. You know, you've got to be aware of that. And it, but then you have faith, because you do it again, you build it up again. Oh, I can actually build this positive pressure up again.
Shall we look into you, Paul?
Oh, God. Oh, good.
We can,
It's not only Jesus, but also God.
It's Jesus and God. Yeah, come on, man. Let's bring them in. It's integration. There's God, there's Jesus.
They need to come down, yeah.
Yeah, they're all coming down. Here we go.
Here we go.
So this is from a book of aphorisms from Sangharakshita called Stream of Stars. And I don't know why I like this. I think probably because I like this quote probably because of... Let me read it first.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes more sense. Okay. Formerly, one needed courage to attack institutions. Now, one needs courage to defend them. And still more courage to create them. I'll read that again, yeah? Formerly, one needed courage to attack institutions. Now, one needs courage to defend them. And still more courage to create them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Well, yeah.
Wow.
No, it kind of struck me because, I've lived in a retreat center in Padmaloka, moving to Berlin. You could call this place an institution. Mm. I've got very positive associations with places like the London Buddha Center, which, I mean, it depends what you think an institution is as well. In a way, it does relate to the poem, you know, in the sense of like, the bigger picture and large numbers of people and a culture and a handing on of something that isn't just you. It's not just you doing some amazing podcast by yourself and then being a celebrity and writing an amazing book and I'm so fabulous. And, you know, actually there's a lot of people involved and you hand on something without even being aware of it. And so I don't know. I just figure like at the moment, just exactly that, what you just said, Yeah, maybe one needed courage to destroy all these negative institutions, but I think building them, really difficult, creating the right culture, generating them. I just wanted to say, read that quote for a kind of positive, a little kind of thumbs up for institutions, actually, because there's a lot of good institutions, and just the word itself now is almost like a dirty word, you know, like we're not really, but I think the reason, and one of the reasons we're so negative about institutions as well is because, yeah, we're in an age of individualism, yeah, where it's all about us. But the only reason we can be that is because we have like massive technologies that, and there's a different kind of what you might call hierarchy or even royalty, you know, in Silicon Valley. And, you know, we think, oh, I'm an individual now, I don't need institutions, it's all online. But it's like, yeah, but there's a back end to that whole online process. You know, there's a whole world behind that. And it's easy to knock down institutions and people trying to build things up with other people. But, you know, not to lose sight of the fact that the only reason we think we're that way is because we've got these internet stuff. And someone that I was watching this great program, it was really obvious, but like these software engineers, they're like, listen, if something's free, that means you're the product. You're paying for something. Yeah. If you think the product's free, it means you're the product.
Yeah.
I think, oh, wow. Anyway, that's a slight tangent. Never mind.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, it's difficult to create institutions and it takes time and effort and commitment. So I think that's probably not very popular.
So what is an institution though? What is it? When you hear the word institution, maybe it's, what is it in German?
Institution.
Okay, good. So what's that?
Well, I think the first thing that came to mind is that it fits perfectly because we talked about conditions, isn't it? So an institution is just something that sets conditions.
Hmm.
Yeah, that sets something that creates a framework.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some institutions are rigid, some institutions are a bit less rigid, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I just think to create an institution, well, in our Buddhist sense, would mean, well, to create a good community, a good, but also a good place, you know, like our retreat center that we've built, that is an institution that allows people to step into that realm.
Mm. So is it a physical place?
It doesn't have to be, but it obviously physicality is a big role, is important. Mm. Like, I think just having our Buddhist center here, having the shrine room, that communicates something already. So communication, I think, happens on different levels, on physicality, on materiality.
And I also think it's probably a way of interacting with each other, which can also be an institution.
Here, aren't we, in the library?
Yeah, of course. I was thinking of course, I mean, we started the community, a women's community, at the beginning of the year. And I think it was also kind of with the question, like, how can we in a city like Berlin, with all the rising rents and all that, create a model or find a way of establishing a community that would also probably not only work for ourselves, but maybe even beyond that. Because we've also been thinking of creating a charity or something, and to kind of create a bit more institutionalized structures that would make it easier for people to kind of copy that model. Because I also feel like it's too difficult if you just come along and you have no idea how shall I do it, and then just having people setting an example is probably quite
it's quite a thing, isn't it?
It's beneficial, I guess.
Because I mean, I guess you have to have the spirit of it needs to be you need to be really in touch with that, don't you? Like the kind of the spirit, like we were talking about the whole transmit, there's that spiritual force. It's quite a thing because you've got to be in touch with that, and at the same time you've also got to be skillful in a worldly sense, if you want to say it in that way. But do you know what I mean? You've got to be able to build things and connect things and sort out things in an office and building projects. There's a whole kind of, but if you just go too weighted on that in terms of like the actual technicalities of it, utilitarian side of it, and you lose the spirit, it just comes empty. And then if you're too in the spirit, so to speak, which isn't actually the spirit, because then you get all kind of self-indulgent. But then I think it's like, there's another great quote in here about Banti talking about energy. If you do have that spirit, to call it that, the natural impulse is to bring it out to people, isn't it? There's a natural wanting to communicate and connect with people. And then I guess you have to figure out what the most effective way of doing that is. So I think there's a huge necessity, especially these days, actually, for places where people can gather communally in larger numbers, meet each other, get things going, you know, and move away from a whole, in a way, from a kind of celebrity culture where you have a kind of, you know, the glorious individual but not, then again, not get all weird and kind of repressive and, you know, oh, no one's better than anyone. You know, these weird things that happen in institutions. I mean, it happened with us, isn't it? In Tree Ratna, we get these weird kind of stuff going on, and you don't want that.
I think it's probably more about a mythic context as well. Like people need a positive myth and something to connect their own myth and their own life stories within a larger myth. So this was an idea of Bhante that I always really, really liked, that he said, we create a mythic context for people so that they can relate their personal myths within a much broader myth, the myth of the Dharma, and the only myth that actually allows you to live a meaningful life in the fullest sense.
I think this place is like that. That's how I experience it. I think that's what other people, people that I meet, they, you know, that are really connected, that's what they say in a way. You know, there's like a broader myth that you can all live together somehow, but explore your own personal world as well within.
And also the quote reminded me of something I just read and I found really inspiring, that Bhante also said, you cannot... Buddhism will only kind of start to take root in our society when we have institutions and when we exemplify institutions and we exemplify lifestyles. So you can't just go on and sit somewhere and meditate. Right. You have to kind of create institutions because otherwise...
I mean, that's just practically true, isn't it?
Because you need... there just need to be normal people who live Buddhist lives and live lives that are different from the rest of the society. So
And there needs to be somewhere to actually... it needs to actually exist.
Yeah.
It's no good just being a Facebook group, you know. It's like you've actually got to exist in the real world, which means bills got to get paid, things got to get done.
It's like I think you know, it needs, like, having a myth or having that kind of intensity of practice that needs to be protected, you know. So I think an institution, I was thinking of that as a protector, or like a gatekeeper almost. That's the institution you use, setting up the community, and you're talking about, well, it needs to function within the world so that within you have actually the freedom to practice and to live out that myth. Because otherwise it'll get just dragged down by, you know, practicalities.
Well, and also you can get diluted as well with other ideas. You do need, I mean, frankly, you do need a strength of tradition. You need, like we're saying, you need people that understand what that tradition is. But then living from the spirit of it rather than the letter, but you need a place where that exists, an actual place. Otherwise... it just, like you say, you get other people turning up with their idea and this idea, and no disrespect to anyone, you know, everyone's got, people have great ideas, but at the end of the day, if you've chosen, if you think, oh, this person actually, like Sangharakshita, for example, if he's your teacher, it's like, oh, this person, you look at their life, you think, they've really done this, they've lived this, and they've done it, this is the person I'm following. That's what you want to be communicating in a way. Otherwise, you just end up with loads of, like he said, loads of mini gurus, you know, you've got loads of these, we're all there kind of being little gurus, and it doesn't really work. But I was interested in this whole thing about, this whole business of saying, him using the word courage. I can understand, you know, if there's a repressive kind of institution, which I'm sure you can bring to mind, you need courage to attack that because you're most likely going to get in big trouble. But then why do you need courage to defend an institution and then also courage to create one? I was thinking about that as well. I mean, me personally, my own experience of being here, is especially in a place like Berlin, there's a whole kind of, I don't know about anti-authoritarian, which is fine. I'm comfortable with that. Every city has its own culture. But there's a real kind of anti-authoritarian, probably for good reasons when you look at what's happened in this place. Just teaching here as well, I find myself now and then, I'm not naming any names, but you know, now and then it's like I find myself, people looking at me like I'm some kind of authority figure, that they're like, oh yeah, who do you think you are then? And it's like, I think Jesus, oh Jesus, I'm back, sorry. But anyway, you know what I mean? I think Jesus, he's like, and what I'm trying to do is communicate something. And you, but you, I think in a way I have actually experienced that as courage in a way, because I feel like the mob sometimes is against me. We're like just saying, oh, can we do it like this or do it like that? It's like, oh, you're the boss, are you? And it's like, no. Well, do you know what I mean? So
anyway, it's that balance, isn't it?
I was just curious about the word courage.
Courage.
And maybe because we're not under pressure, but you can easily imagine, like, things can change here. They certainly change in other parts of the world where you probably do need courage to defend an institution, actually.
Well, just in a practical sense, just working in the office here, or, you know, Singer and Ivy on the management team here, you know, it's like the day-to-day business of it is already, you know, that we're really trying to set up a place where we don't have to bother about what we're actually doing here, you know, because there's so much coming in from the outside trying to, oh, why don't you do it like this? Why don't you do that? You know, I'm doing the emails. There's
a lot of courageous work.
suggestions coming in. But then obviously you want to be, I think that's the that's the tricky bit, is like you want to be open for, well, what does the world need? But then also you need to be very, very firm in your own understanding of the Dharma, you know, the Buddhist teaching. So you want to be, you need to be quite wise, I think, in order to make the right decision to say, well, we're not doing that, thank you very much. But yeah, we are going to do this.
Because you will get the hate off it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, if it just happens, you know, you start suggesting certain things. Yeah. And you get this in a completely non-institutional world now, where there's a kind of people are not keen on hierarchy at all. There's all these weird hierarchies and perceived hierarchy. You probably do need a bit of courage, actually, to just create institutions that... anyway, I'm all for them, you know, in a good sense. If you can hand someone something, because it's like to do with your life's work at the end of the day, it's like, you know, I would hope that all of this stuff completely outlives all of us, you know, everyone here, everyone living. You'd hope that there's some... otherwise, what's the point? You know, you'd hope there's some kind of generational handing on and some kind of something that outlives your own life.
Yeah, but I really think that, for that, we really need a sense of tradition somehow. And we need to create something where it's much stronger for people to grasp our lineage and what we want to kind of hand on. And I think this is also something that probably isn't, it's probably not even easy within Triyatna itself to
not
kind
easy
of create,
amongst all the members
to create that sense of what is it that we want to pass on. And I think that's where the courage is as well, because I think it really needs, because otherwise I don't think that it something will survive without that strong root in the kind of lineage of those who've gone before. Otherwise it will just be too whatever, it will disperse.
And I think you've got to also be, I guess my feeling, especially being here, is like you've got to be sensitive to the actual spirit of things when it kind of emerges, either in somebody you know or collectively, to be like, oh no, actually this is it. So I've had it where it's almost crept up on me from behind, you know. I've been like, oh, do this, do that, and we create this class, and the Bhante said this, and we do, and then you look and there's a little pocket of something where something's actually alive. You're like, oh no, that's it. You know what I mean? It's like you do all the technicalities and now and then stuff, wherever it happens, whether it's here or my main point of context before is like in London and these little, and Padmalok, and these little places where it kind of pops up and you're like, oh, right, that's it. And it's not like a given, like, oh, it's going to be forever. But you get a time, you just like this little flame, you've got to kind of fan the flame somehow and pay attention to it. And because I think that carries the tradition, doesn't it, actually?
That
living
spirit.
It's alive. Yeah. That's what's carrying it forward. And that's what's attractive to people as well. Otherwise, it's just like, well, why would you get into it if you didn't feel it?
Ungraspable
and mysterious. Yeah. And nothing to do with Jesus.
That's what I meant. Yeah. Good. I think we're towards the end. Well, that was very good.
It was a really enjoyable conversation.
Very good. Let's do it again.
Yeah. Let's do it again. Well, thanks, you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks for listening.
Great.
See you.
Happy Christmas. I'm not allowed to support Jesus anymore. No. But happy Christmas.
Well, it's the pagan
Jesus
ritual of solstice, winter solstice. Happy winter solstice.
Fantastic.
See you next year.
Bye.
Or hear you next year.
Yeah. Ciao.